we'd like to capture your minds right now. Take you a little bit higher.
This is Indie Media On Air for the week of June 11, 2007. On today's show, we'll learn about the struggle to start a community-based radio station in Soweto, South Africa. We'll also hear how the United States has used its nuclear arsenal to expand its empire and maintain its interests around the world. I'm Bronwyn Malden with the Los Angeles Independent Media Center. Once a month, Indie Media On Air highlights the work of independent media makers around the globe. Today's pieces come to us from Soweto, South Africa, Vancouver, British Columbia, and Champaign, Urbana, Illinois. This is KPFK, 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM Santa Barbara.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
A landmark study of radio ownership in the United States published by Free Press makes a compelling case for more media diversity. Off the Dial meticulously analyzed the ownership and control of every radio station in America and found that less than one out of every eight stations is owned by women or people of color. You can find women-owned stations in just 40% of all local radio markets, and minority-owned stations in just about half. What's worse, female and non-white-owned radio stations are more likely to be independent and more likely to provide diversity in programming. It was independent stations just like these that were decimated in the wave of consolidation that swept through the radio industry following the passage of the Telecommunications Act of 1996, meaning this problem has accelerated over the last 10 years and current media policies are only making it worse. This has FCC Commissioner Jonathan Adelstein gravely concerned.
What we see here, the study is extremely alarming. Minorities and women have been left off the dial because the FCC has pursued policies that are far off the mark.
Commissioner Michael Copps calls it, quote, a national disgrace.
It's not that they're riding in the back of the bus when it comes to media ownership. They're not even on the bus.
What's more, according to Brent Wilkes, the executive director of the League of United Latin American Citizens, is that the homogenization of programming by mostly white male station owners is detrimentally skewing debate on the important political questions of our time, such as immigration.
The lack of diversity, the lack of local content, actually is moving the policy debate in an anti-minority, anti-women agenda, because the real people out there in the communities don't have access to the airwaves, and the vocal minority is getting that access because the owners of these stations provide that to them.
Mark Lloyd with the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights says examination of radio diversity is long overdue and our public officials owe us more.
In 1996, Congress required the FCC to study the problems of ownership in small businesses and minorities and women in the media industry. The FCC has not done this study.
Changing the radio ownership landscape in favor of creating more diversity at the local level may go a long way toward diversifying content on the dial, though hip-hop historian and journalist Davey D says simply changing the gender and color of those at the top of the currently conglomerated radio industry will not solve the problem of women and minorities being stereotyped and misrepresented in the media.
Seeing a station like Radio 1, which is often lauded because Kathy Hughes is a black woman who owns a lot of stations, yet she has a lot of complaints when we have our meetings around media because she's just as bad as the Clear Channels.
How can this problem be addressed? The FCC could promulgate new rules to encourage more local ownership among radio stations, and Congress could re-implement tax incentives for larger broadcasters to sell off stations to the underrepresented, or re-establish national caps on how many stations a single company can own. Gloria Steinem, founder of Ms. Magazine and co-founder of Greenstone Media, a talk radio network wholly focused on women, says this new research may help push a fix to the four.
It has become bad enough so that it has to get better. It has nowhere to go downward.
To learn more about the state of radio ownership involving women and people of color, you can read the full report at www.stopbigmedia.com and click on the front page link Off the Dial.
Is the Corporation for Public Broadcasting on another hunt for objectivity? CPB CEO Patricia Harrison says she's tried hard to undo the damage done by a former partisan plant, which used to hold her job. That was Kenneth Tomlinson, best known for going on a witch hunt against so-called liberal bias in public broadcast programming, conduct which brought the ire of the CPB's own Inspector General and Congress and resulted in him stepping away from the CPB under a cloud of disgrace. Although Patricia Harrison herself used to chair the Republican National Committee, she's gained the respect of many NPR and PBS member stations by making public broadcasting funding and management more transparent. Now she's asking the deans of 9 journalism schools to help define what the words objectivity and balance mean in the context of public broadcasting. However, Harrison admits the CPB does not have the power to impose such standards on public radio and TV programming, nor does she have an agenda of her own.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
The G8 summit ended last week with the rich countries of the global north making symbolic and fairly meaningless pledges of cash and debt relief to relieve poverty in Africa. Bono and Bob Geldof are generating lots of publicity for themselves with their complaints that the sums committed by the U.S. and other wealthy countries are far too small to have a meaningful impact. While that may be true, what's more important is what isn't being said by the politicians and celebrities that command mainstream media coverage. No one seems to want to address the economic, political, and social structures that create poverty in Africa. The global trade treaties that benefit us in the North at the expense of the global South. The rapacious transnational corporations that take raw goods from African, Asian, and Latin American countries at bargain prices, then make themselves rich selling expensive processed goods back to the poor. American and European oil companies that buy off elected officials in oil-producing states and hire whole armies to threaten and kill local activists who demand some share of the wealth. If you followed coverage of the G8 summit on the Indie Media website, you heard a very different story. Social justice activists from around the world converged on the city of Heiligendamm in Germany to demand real, meaningful change in the global political economy. At one point, they literally shut the city down. Delegates to the meeting could only get in and out of the city by helicopter or boat. But when talking about poverty in Africa, the other part of the story that never gets enough attention here is that of the work being done by Africans for social justice in their own communities. You can find these stories, but only if you know where to look. Pambazuka News is an online forum where Africans are telling their own stories of struggles for social justice. In Swahili, the word Pambazuka means dawn or arise. Pambazuka News is a pan-African electronic weekly newsletter and platform for social justice in Africa. It offers comprehensive weekly coverage, cutting-edge commentary, and in-depth analysis on politics and current affairs, development, human rights, refugees, gender issues, and culture in Africa. It is intended as a tool for progressive social change. More than 300 issues have been produced since 2001. Pambazuka News also produces audio and video broadcasts, including the one I'm going to play now. It's an interview with Molefi Ndlovu, a community activist in Soweto. He's interviewed by Sokari Akine, who's well known in her own right as the author of the blog Black Looks.
This is Sokari Akine for Pambazuka News at the University of KZN in Durban, South Africa. I'm talking with Molefe Ndlovu, who was part of the South African Indimidi group that started the community radio station in Soweto Township called Rasa Radio. Rasa Radio was eventually shut down by the government for failing to meet government license requirements for radio stations. However, Molefe asserts that it was the success of Rasa that ultimately led to its closure.
We ran a low-power radio station using a transmitter and some equipment donated by Indimedia International, actually Indimedia New York, where they gave us a low-power transmitter and an amp. And the idea was for us to see if we can set up a radio station using ideas of collective media production at a community level, but also getting young people to be involved in some of the issues that are facing communities in Soweto. We ran the station from the garage of an activist in the Soweto Electricity Crisis Committee, Trevor Ngwane, who gave us a space.
So what sort of programs did you have? Because you just mentioned to me now that you were inviting women to come and speak and youth to come and speak and so on.
Well, actually, the Rasa project was an attempt at somehow breaking down the spaces that commercial radio had occupied in most of the communities, where many people in the local area, especially in Pimville, for instance, were mourning the fact that the local radio station that was there has tilted more towards corporate or commercial interests. So the types of people they would invite in the studio, the types of music they would play, and also the issues they would frontline were quite linked to the ideas of marketability and so on. So what we tried to do there was to get the space functional so that we can get community people, ordinary women in the townships with nothing to do in the afternoons, to just use the microphone as a way to communicate and reach out to other groupings there. But we also gave it, we consciously wanted to bring along also the layer of young talented artists and creative young people that were looking for outputs or places that they can express their discontent sometimes, but also their creative spirits, which they were not finding in the radio stations there. So basically, we had to, the whole station had to, the way we started it, we had to run around with workshopping the idea of a radio station first. So the main thing that we did was to hold community forums where people would speak about what they would want a radio station in their places to have, what sort of content in the, you know, the programs and so on, but also how they would want it to run in terms of their own participation in it. And out of those, we had a series of consultations that lasted for about a six-week period. And out of that, we merged with a solid group of youths mainly that were committed to be at the station and helping out with different aspects of it.
How did you organize the workshops? I mean, did you try to organize it so you got a cross-section of the population, of the community, or was it just the youth?
That was the interesting thing. The first time we tried it, actually, we thought we could walk into a community hall in Deep Kloof, so put up a banner there and make a noise and say people and expect people to come through. It was actually quite sobering because we ended up organizing sound and everything, and we just hoped people would trickle in, and it didn't work like that. We actually had to go to local organizations in the area, wait for their public meetings. Often, especially the Soweto Crisis Committee would meet on Wednesdays. We actually had to go to the community meeting there and come up with this idea and say, look, this is what we are wanting to do. We want you guys to be involved. Are there local people that we can get hold of in the areas and so on? And there, at least, we were embraced quite wholeheartedly because a lot of these groupings were starting to say, you know, we've been mobilizing, we've been fighting for individual things, but we've not been hearing each other across the township and across, you know, our different situations. So the way that we organized the workshop then was firstly a series of meetings, the different community meetings, and then out of those meetings we then agreed on a date for a centralized sort of workshop, which would include components of who we want Rasa to be. It would include the youth, it will include people that are in the organizations, local organizations. It would also include affected persons like the unemployed mothers and the aunts and so on. At that meeting then we put out a proposal for what our programs would look like. Maybe I could go into that. Basically, we planned a programming schedule that lasted from 7 to 7 p.m. Note you also, all of this we're doing it with an awareness that it's not a registered station. So a lot of people are still not sure whether it would work out to have a 7 day. Yeah.
So what were the implications of actually operating the radio station without a license?
Well, firstly, it was a jail term, basically, and a fine, a heavy one. In fact, we were made to know of this quite late before we got to shut down. But we didn't just go in there and just switch on the lights and so on. We did a lot of consultation with the Freedom of Expression Institute in Johannesburg, where we just wanted to find out whether there is a legal framework that could regulate the setting up of low-power radio stations. And it was found there that in the current media legislation, there is no stipulations on how that process should go about. And out of the advice of the Freedom of Expression Institute, they advised us perhaps we could use it as a pilot project where if we are able to demonstrate sufficiently that there's enough interest and that the concept could also be polished up to such an extent that it could also inform legislation around low-power radio stations and so on, then the case for RASA would be strong. So that's how we got into it. We thought we would start a pilot, and the success of the pilot would strengthen with the call for better legislation, or if there does not exist some, then some legislation, so that communities at a direct level can take part in the production of media.
So basically, the purpose of RASA was twofold. On the one level, it was to act as a medium towards changing legislation for community radio, but it was also a place where local communities could talk about the activism and the particular issues that they were facing and that they wanted to have dealt with, such as electricity problems, water problems, housing, and so on.
Yeah, that's it. But the major challenge that we got was the question of the commercial interests, both from the side of the regulating body, ICASA, as well as the competing radio stations there, where they were making an argument that because of the way that the local community radio regulations are stipulated, they also have got responsibilities to their commercial supporters. So advertisers at the radio station expect a certain number of listenership at a particular time and so on. So to set up another radio station in an area that is supposed to be the footprint area of this recognized commercial radio station could possibly undermine the interests of that station insofar as it won't be able to guarantee that between 12 and 1 it can get the number of listeners that it had sold its space to advertisers for. I must also make a note that we set out intentionally to develop an approach to radio that wants to undermine this marriage between corporate interests and the people that are providing the service. So we intentionally did not go out and solicit support from the big corporations like Coca-Cola and all of those advertisers. What we ended up doing rather was to invite local people, you know, with spaza shops and so on, not for a fee, but they could, for instance, contribute lunch for the people that are volunteering at the station as a way, you know, and then we can have an interview with them at the station to tell us about their business and so on. So the idea of building a sense of community, even in terms of the way that communities sustain themselves, which is quite different from this new ethic of, you know, standardizing radio so that it is, you know, it looks the same. Because at the moment, Josie FM, which is the local radio station in Soweto, is very similar to YFM, which is a privately owned radio entity, because they consider themselves as competing for the same market. And we're trying to get away from the notion of the audience as the market, but the audience also as the pool of the people that produce, you know, some of these things, so that it's not only reflecting, always evoked from the mic to the people, but the people themselves invoke. And then what we saw ourselves is the different DJs of the different sessions. Each one of us had their own personalities, by the way. Each show was quite different, and it expressed the difference of the people that hosted. But primarily what we wanted to do there is to act as facilitators for, you know, some of those things to happen. Not necessarily to drive them, but to be able to, you know, connect it up with the larger project and other things that the people that would be speaking on may not have necessarily had the immediate connections to. Yeah.
So, for example, so if I had a particular problem as a mother at home and I was having issues of electricity, for example, I could actually come to the radio station and say, look, I want to speak about this problem that I'm having with the electricity company who have been harassing me, and so on and so forth. Was that the kind of thing that anybody could do?
Yeah. As I was saying, we ran from 7 to 7, and the way that we organized our programs was thematic. So the first session, for instance, there were in all about 6 sessions. Yeah. The first session would be more like your morning entertainment and so on, news, updates, sports, and that sort of thing. And then the second half of the session, which usually starts around 10 o'clock to 12 o'clock, that's the time that we dedicated to, you know, we called it burning issues. So whatever burning issues that were emerging from the communities, whether they are individual household issues or organizational issues and so on, they would be the focus area. We would often have a theme, for instance, in the burning session, we would thematize it. Maybe our focus is on education. Are we getting free education? And we would find people that would be part of that session, speaking from their backgrounds, include some aspects of music, some aspects of poetry, aspects of readings and so on, so that the problem is not always just about, you know, victimhood, but it's also a conscious effort at building the alternatives, you know, there, you know, where women would be complaining about water and electricity cutoffs, we would connect them up to an organization that we know that does things like that. But at the same time, we would get other creative voices that would speak about the same problem, not necessarily at an immediate experience point, but at a, you know, the larger reflective. So we are trying to fuse, you know, the politics of everyday survival with those of the survival of the intellect, you know, and all of that. So we're trying to also bridge the gap of what is considered community knowledge and what is, you know, more informed analysis and all of that, so that the two could almost complement each other in a way. Yeah.
So what went wrong?
Well, I think what went wrong is that everything went right.
Okay, that's fair. That's a good way of putting it.
Basically, the station grew bigger than any of us would have imagined initially. From the first day we launched it, that was June 16, 2005, we were expecting, you know, like, okay, people will be listening, da, 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 da. But it turned out that by fate or by, I don't know, luck or whatever, we were situated between SAFM and Josie FM in the dial. And those are the most popular dials in terms of listeners, taxi drivers, everyone, you know, people listen to those two stations. And a lot of people bumped into the station by default, really. And the news spread like hot fire from the first day that we started broadcasting. The next day, when we got to the station, there were people waiting at the gates, wanting to be on air and so on. And by the third week we had started broadcasting, it was almost like a movement, because we had kids coming from the Eastern coming to say, hey, when is Rasa opening offices in the Eastern? You know, we're having to travel all this way to talk about these things. In the city center, Joburg city center, we had a lot of cultural activities there, and a lot of young people were migrating to the city center to do their performance. Da, da, da. We were finding that the trend was reversing. In fact, people were huge exoduses of people were leaving the city center over weekends to go into events in the township. So not only were we at the physical station, people at the different youth events, you know, hip hop sessions, poetry sessions, between the performances and things, they would switch on to the station, and we would be, you know, communicating with them through the station. They would be calling us, and we would be broadcasting to other people. But also the taxi driver drivers also, which is quite an important group of people there at the Barra taxi rank, for instance. A lot of them would just be blazing Rasa FM from their radios. So I think a lot of people got to know about it, and that could have been also a downfall on our side, because then Josie FM and others became even more aggressive in their determination to shut us down. We were opening up another can of worms for, the whole media industry itself, because they had not stopped to think around how, if the technology is there, when communities do have the technology and when they do take over the airwaves, how does that, how would they respond to it? So, yeah, what went wrong? The first thing that happened is we got informed by our links all over the township that people had started seeing these surveillance vans from ICASA with those huge antennas, and it was clear that they were trying to pinpoint where the station was.
This is Indie Media on Air on KPFK 90.7 FM Los Angeles, 98.7 FM, Santa Barbara. You're listening to an interview with Molefe Ndlovu, radical community radio activist in Soweto, South Africa. He's interviewed by Sakari Akine of Pambazuka News. To learn more about Pambazuka News and to hear more interviews with African social justice activists, visit the KPFK website and click over to the link for the Indie Media On Air program. Stay tuned. We'll be back with the rest of the interview in just a moment.
To explore, discover, pave the way for future disintegration and so-called civilization. As if there was no civilization. And sending missionaries for mental preparation and spiritual conquer. Through the Bible in one hand, the guns in the other. At Berlin 1884, the scramble for Africa became official. Led by Germany, Britain, France, Belgium, etc. To divide the piece of cake. Balkanize Africa. Divide and rule. Balkanize.